At that time in 1966, there was nothing much which could be done for these patients. No medication altered their state. Some things did alter their state briefly. Sometimes if you threw a ball to a patient, they could catch it suddenly. If you played music, they might be able to dance or sing. And sometimes if they sneezed, that would bring them to for about 30 seconds. And they would be suddenly alive and vivid and talking, and you would realize what an intensely human and healthy person there was inside. And then the doors would close, and the person would be imprisoned in this state again, and there was not much you could do. Until this drug, L-DOPA, came along.
That's Oliver Sacks on The Science Show back in 1992. Oliver Sacks was a British neurologist, a brain doctor, who became famous in 1985 for a book called The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, a book about patients he'd treated whose brains interpreted the world in ways which, well, seemed pretty odd to the rest of us. Many more books followed, and you might be one of the people who read them, one of the many people who read them, and there were films about his work too. Well, he died not quite 2 years ago in Manhattan, aged 82, and the lovely thing is that we now have a very tender book about Oliver Sacks by the man who loved him. It's also a love letter to New York. It's called Insomniac City. Bill Hayes is best known for his book about that classic text, Gray's Anatomy. It's called The Anatomist, and he's a very penetrating photographer. His shots of New York and of New Yorkers populate this book, and he joins us now from a studio in New York. Bill Hayes, welcome to Books and Arts.
Thank you for having me.
How would you describe the Oliver Sacks who we got to know through those books? I mean, he was talking there about Awakenings, his very first book. Who was that man?
An unusually brilliant, curious, empathetic, well-read neurologist, doctor, writer, with incredible range, a dozen books in his lifetime on a whole range of topics from neurological disorders and conditions, as he wrote about in Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, to travel pieces, his book Oaxaca Journal or The Island of the Colorblind. And then toward the end of his life, a man who was a master at the personal essay, writing in what are now a series of classic essays about facing illness and death.
Mm. And you knew that man first, as the rest of us did you, Bill? You were aware of his work.
I did. Yeah, I was a writer. I was living in San Francisco. I had read The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat in college, and I had read his beautiful memoir about his childhood and his love of chemistry called Uncle Tungsten. And I had just recently read Musicophilia when 9 years ago, about this time, 9 years ago, I got a letter in the mail from Oliver Sacks, a handwritten letter in the mail, to my surprise. And he had read my book, The Anatomist, and wrote a letter just to say how much he had enjoyed it. And I remember he said in the letter that both of his parents had been physicians. So he had grown up in a household with Gray's Anatomy, the classic 19th century anatomy textbook, and had never really known the story behind it. And that was what my book was about. So it was a very cordial letter, and I was very flattered, very surprised, because I knew his work so well. And of course, I wrote a letter back.
Yeah. And then you met him. And that first meeting, that first meeting wasn't like a romantic tryst. It was, you were a kind of fan, I guess, were you?
Well, I'd say it was a meeting of two writers, to be honest. As I said, he'd written me a letter. I wrote back. We had a little correspondence. And I was making a trip to New York and at his invitation agreed to meet for lunch. So we had lunch at a cafe near his office. And it was professional and cordial, but at the same time, there was definitely a kind of definitely a spark, at least of friendship. Here was a very, very intriguing man. And at the time, I was still living in San Francisco, but about a year later, I would move to New York City.
So he was 76. You were just 49. Mm-hmm. When did you know you were falling in love?
Well, pretty quickly. I moved to New York in April 2009, and by the summertime, it was definitely a romance. A romance with Oliver Sacks and definitely a romance with New York City. And that is what my book Insomniac City is really about. It's about those two relationships. And in the book, I try to weave together stories about my life in New York and on the streets of New York and in the subways and taxi cabs and all the different characters I met and photographed. And then my life with Oliver, much of which took place inside our apartment in the West Village.
Well, you do this beautifully. You weave from one to the other. You're with Bill in the apartment, and then you look out your window and there's New York, and you go out into New York and you take us on these lovely journeys through the streets. His own biography came out the year that he died, and it was only then that he revealed that he was gay. And I get the idea from the way you talk about him that for most of his life he just didn't think about his own sexuality. It seems extraordinary because he's such a deeply reflective man.
He had led really what I think of now as a kind of monk-like life, a life devoted to his patience and his practice and to writing, and had led an incredibly productive life. But you're right. Romance and domestic relationships were not part of that life. And as he told me that summer, as we got to know one another, he had never had a long-term romantic relationship at all. And in fact, he hadn't had sex in 3.5 decades. So that was a very intriguing combination. This very brilliant man who at age 75, he actually was also ready to open his heart and explore love and explore romance and a domestic life. So while my book in some ways is about my own reinvention, moving to New York at age 48, starting a new life after a lifetime on the West Coast and in San Francisco, in a way, the book is also about Oliver's reinvention, reinventing himself at 75 and, as I said, opening his heart to love and to romance.
Yeah, well, you're putting your own life back together because you'd lost a long-term partner over there on the West Coast to AIDS. And so, you know, you're in grief from that. And then you meet this man. So it's a very healing relationship for you both. You write beautifully in this book, well, about so many intimate details. And one of the ways you're able to be so intimate is that you share with us writings from your own journal. I wonder whether you'd mind reading us your entry for July the 9th, 2009.
This is from that first summer in New York. And actually, it was Oliver's 76th birthday. Notes from a journal, July 9th, 2009. O's 76th birthday. After I kiss him for a long time, exploring his mouth and lips with my tongue, he has a look of utter surprise on his face, eyes still closed. Is that what kissing is, or is that something you've invented? I laugh, disarmed. I tell him it's patented. He's sworn to secrecy. O smiles. And if I hold you closely enough, I can hear your brain, I tell him.
It's so lovely. Is that what kissing is? I mean, that really sums up the sense of wonder, really childish wonder with which this very wise man meets the world, it seems, on a daily basis.
That's absolutely true. I mean, he did meet the world with that kind of wonder every day and every night about almost everything. He was wide-eyed and curious about so many things. He was a man so knowledgeable in his own field, of course, neurology and medicine, but had great curiosity and passion for learning, whether it was about ferns or botany or minerals or elements or evolution, travel. He was a very curious person. And I think although Oliver and I were very different in many, many ways, he was almost 30 years older than me. British, Oxford-educated, a doctor, whereas I had grown up in a pretty small town in Washington State and had lived my life as an out gay man, had a long-term relationship. One way in which I think we were, one thing we really had in common was a kind of curiosity about the world and about people. But we explored it, I think, in different ways. I explored my curiosity maybe through photography and through stories, and Oliver through his case histories and his writing on different neurological conditions and disorders.
He was so curious about the world, and yet he wouldn't have recognized this. 'Cause this is What did he make, or what did you make of the fact that there's this great ocean of popular culture that he just never even stepped into? That, of course, was Michael Jackson singing Thriller.
That was amazing to me. I relate in my book how the day after Michael Jackson died, I was talking about it, and Oliver said to me, "What is Michael Jackson?"
Yeah, what?
Not even who, but what.
Yeah.
He really did not know, and he was not being pretentious. He just really didn't know. He, as he himself admitted, he knew nothing really about popular culture after 1955, so even the Beatles were not on his radar. In some ways, it was like living with someone who had stepped out of a time machine from the 19th century. He just did not have that interest in popular culture. But at the same time, I have to say, he was open to learning. The curiosity was still there. So I had grown up in the 1970s in Washington State. I had five sisters. Michael Jackson was part of my life. And I could explain to him why his passing was a milestone, why Michael Jackson was a brilliant artist. And I can't say that Oliver really got his music, but he understood his importance and his artistry.
Well, he was much more at home with this kind of sound. This is Glenn Gould playing one of the Goldberg variations.
Oh, that was the soundtrack to our life, I swear. Heaven for Oliver Sacks was having his Bose radios in every room of the apartment going at the same time, playing the same Goldberg variations.
Mm. Well, me too.
Beautiful.
I can't have enough Goldberg variations. I'm glad there's so many of them. This is Books and Arts on RN with Michael Cathcart. And my guest is the New York writer Bill Hayes and photographer Bill Hayes. He's written a very intimate book about his relationship with the neurologist Oliver Sacks and also with New York City. The book is called Insomniac City. So this, as I say, is also a book about New York, the city that never sleeps. Now, I'm going to play you a sound, Bill, and I'd love you just to tell us where we are and what this place means to you as we continue to move through this sound world. Here we go.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Okay, so we're obviously in the train and it's pulling out of the station. Where are we, Bill?
We're in a subway in New York City, underneath the streets of Manhattan.
And what are we seeing around us? What's in the carriage with us?
Oh, a whole spectrum of people. The thing I loved about the subways, and still do, the subways of New York City, is how every car on every train and every line is a surprise. You never know who's going to walk through the door. It's like a whole new cast of characters every time the train doors open and a whole new rush of people come in and line up and sit on the benches. Sometimes I just look at the lineup on a bench and I have to smile to myself because the juxtapositions of people who would probably otherwise never be seated together are sitting there waiting for their stop and making the best of things. And for me, that those subway rides almost define what it is to be a New Yorker. So I do write quite lovingly about the subways of New York. Not everyone has my same perspective, but I still really get a kick out of the subways.
Mm. Well, the first time I went to New York, to go down to the subway was like an iconic experience. It was like going to a place I'd read about in literature, because all those names that are so well known, you know, are there. But as you say, you meet New Yorkers in all their diversity. I mean, I can't imagine anyone visiting New York and not imagining the life they might have had or even the career they might have had if they've lived in that astonishing city.
Mm-hmm.
So you walk around the streets taking photos of people, very intimate portraits. How does that work, Bill? How do you negotiate these sessions, these encounters?
Well, I depend on chance and just pure chance. I really had never pursued photography seriously before moving to New York. I had a camera. And it was a way at first for me just to explore this new city. I would put the camera in my pocket and hop on a subway and go to a neighborhood that I didn't know, whether the Lower East Side or Jackson Heights or Harlem or the Upper East Side, and get out and walk around and explore and take pictures of people. I was always drawn to taking pictures of people. And my approach from the very beginning has always been the same 8 years ago as it is today. When I see someone or a couple or a group of people who, for one reason or another, catch my eye and I see the picture even almost before I see the person, I approach them and I ask permission, may I take your picture? So there is, they do become almost like portraits, but they're very fast. It's a very quick encounter. And when they work well, there's a sense of immediate trust between myself and the subject, even though we're complete strangers. And so this is what I would do often in my years with Oliver. And, you know, whether I was just walking for an appointment or going out deliberately to take photos, come back at the end of the day and show him the photos I had taken on the streets of New York. And he would read to me what he had written that day, which he always wrote in longhand with a fountain pen on pads of paper. So this coming together at the end of the day was very much a part of our domestic life and something I try to capture in the book. It was something that I think brought great joy to Oliver. He had never had that kind of domestic life where coming together at the end of the day, opening a bottle of wine, preparing dinner, setting a table, talking about your day, that became a very sweet part of our life. And one thing I think listeners and readers need to understand is that there was no technology in our apartment. Oliver never sent a text or email in his life. There was not a computer in the apartment, no Wi-Fi. So there was a kind of quietness to our life and that I loved and that allowed for that kind of conversation, which is captured in the book. It's a life which is contrasted with life outside, life on the streets of New York.
There is one piece of technology in your apartment that really tickled my fancy. It's a bath thermometer. I didn't know there was such a thing as a bath thermometer, but Oliver had one. What's the point of a bath thermometer?
Oh, the temperature of the bathwater was very important to Oliver. He was a great taker of baths and had a beautiful bathtub, but the temperature had to be exactly right. He was very precise about things. So 102 Fahrenheit was too low, and 112 was way too hot, but his preferred temperature was 106. So it was a very large thermometer, which he would put into the water and wait a few seconds and pull it out. It was large enough so that Oliver could read it without a magnifying glass. He had very poor vision, as you probably know, blind in one eye from cancer and had cataracts in the other eye. So to read, he often had to use magnifying glasses. But the thermometer was large enough that he could see.
I've raised this as though it's desperately eccentric, but now I realise, as you explain it, that there are radio listeners all over Australia who'll be saying, where can I get a bath thermometer, one that's large enough for me able to read? Because you know, as your eyes fail and you go into the bathroom, you take your glasses off and then you can't read the labels on any bottles.
Absolutely.
They always write shampoo in tiny letters, so you don't know whether you've got shampoo or conditioner. It's a nightmare. Why don't they make them bigger? So we all want a bath thermometer with a great big dial on it. Bill, you take us also through Oliver's death in a very trusting and open way. I mean, he faced death with his usual mixture of, well, I'm not sure it's wonder, but there's a kind of rationality and modesty to the way in which he faced death. And then mm-hmm. you went away and wrote this book in 5 weeks, you say.
Right. You know, it was difficult to write about that last period in Oliver's life, and yet he himself had written about facing his illness and facing mortality so beautifully and with such clarity and such elegance and such candor that I felt writing about it from my perspective was something I would want to do and try to do with the same kind of respect and clarity, and also to show readers that Oliver really did live his life to the very end the way he had hoped and intended and the way he wrote about in those essays, as richly and productively as possible. About 6 months, I guess, after he died, I did approach writing this book. I'd gotten a fellowship at the American Academy in Rome, and I think having the distance from New York and from our life there helped, and it came together in an almost magical way in about 5 weeks, pulling together parts from a journal I had kept during our whole life together, and memories and stories about my life in New York, as well as my photographs.
Well, it's a lovely compilation. I have loved reading this book, Bill. Thank you so much for sharing something very intimate and beautiful with the rest of us. It's been a joy to have you here on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.